Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we are going to have part two of our interview with Mark Martinez, who is going to talk about his upcoming documentary about the golden era of bodybuilding. It's called Dream Big, and Mark has been working on this project of his for about 5 or 6 years. And we're going to talk a little bit more today about the making of that documentary. And Mark is hoping to release it at the Venice Film Festival in Venice, California. I believe it's the beginning of October of this year. So very exciting project, especially for those of us who love the golden age of bodybuilding, which in this case will be around the 1970s. And then after we talk to Mark, which is part two of our interview, I am going to read another article from the May 1979 issue of Muscle Builder magazine. And this was as Frank Zane was getting prepared for his third Mr. Olympia attempt, which he did win in 1979. And the name of the article is called "I'll Win Mr. Olympia Third Time, Here's Why." And this was also the cover of the magazine, a very cool cover and a very nice picture of Frank Zane. And it's had the same thing on the cover. "I'll win Mr. Olympia third time. Here's why." So cool article. And I'm sure all you Frank Zane fans out there will love it. All right. Before we get to that, though, I do want to mention our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can just go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. They have offices all over the United States, but they can work with anybody in the continental United States just through their website. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they'll give you a free consultation. Plus, they'll give you 20% off your first order. All right. So I had a very busy weekend. I was at the Tampa Pro, which took place on August 6th and 7th, Friday and Saturday. And there all weekend. It was right down the street from me at the Grand Hyatt Hotel. So before I get to that, though, I do want to mention some very bad news. We had another passing in our industry. It seems like I talk about this every week. It seems like somebody from our industry passes away. This was a big one, John Meadows. And John was a bodybuilder, a pro bodybuilder. But more than that, he was a coach. And he coached a lot of people. A lot of other bodybuilders, and he had a really huge YouTube channel. I think about 250,000 viewers on his YouTube channel, and he was very prolific on that channel, putting out 2 to 3 videos a week. A real expert on training and training styles, and I was a big fan of John's YouTube channel. I always watched it, and I learned a lot from it. And more than that, though, John was just a really good person, very nice guy. And you can just tell in this industry, at least the bodybuilding industry, he really stood out because he was very genuine and really wanted to help people. And you could tell that just by listening to him when he talked. He just came across that way. And this, I think he just passed away Saturday night. I think it was in his sleep. I heard it was a pulmonary embolism, which is like a blood clot in your lungs. I know about a year ago, John was having problems with his heart. I think he had a mild heart attack. And I remember he did a video on his YouTube channel where he actually had his doctor, who was also his client, and they talked about his blood work. And the doctor was very frank about with John about how severe that heart attack was. So anyways, I don't know if this was related to that or not, but John passed away in his sleep on Saturday night, and we all heard about it yesterday on social media, and Facebook was just flooded with memorials from people that knew John, that worked with John, that were inspired by John, that appreciated his YouTube channel. I knew John as well. I wasn't good friends with him. I didn't talk with him all the time. I didn't have his phone number. We didn't text. But when I saw him at a show, of course, he knew me. I knew him. And I just appreciated all the contributions he made to the sport of bodybuilding. And like I said, all these sentiments that were sent out on Facebook yesterday were just all about what a great person he was. It wasn't about John the bodybuilder or even John the coach. It was just more about how great of a person he was, how he really cared, how he was very genuine, and he was a really good person. And it's so sad when you see someone that good of a person pass away. We don't want to see those guys go away at all. And John was only 49 years old, and it's very young. It's just such a shame. He leaves behind, I believe, two children and his wife and his many fans. I mean, he's touched probably millions of people with all of his teachings and all of the things that he's done. So real, real sad news yesterday in the sport. We're losing a lot of people in the sport. It's really, really sad. And I don't know if social media just makes us all more aware of it. It seems like every week I'm hearing about somebody dying that I know. So this was a real sad one. So rest in peace, John Meadows, and all the best to his family, to his wife, to his kids, and all of his relatives, and of course, all of his fans that are really going to miss him. It was a really sad, sad day in our industry when that happened. All right. So talking about the Tampa Pro, huge show. I believe this was the 14th annual Tampa Pro that Tim Gardner and his wife Eileen put on every year. And Tim has all of the divisions, not just bodybuilding, but he has bikini, fitness, figure, women's bodybuilding, men's bodybuilding, 212 class, classic physique, everything, men's physique. So it was a two-day show, and then they had the amateur portion of it, which is called the MPC Tim Gardner Extravaganza. That was on Saturday night. And so it was a very, very busy weekend, and I tried to be there for all of it. I took a couple days off work, and I was there for the pre-judging. I was there for the night shows, and I did a wrap-up on it on Digital Muscle. So I'll put that link to that report on this podcast, so you can check it out below. And today I was on RX Muscle with Dave Palumbo and Chris Aceto and John Romano. And they had me on there to talk also about the Tampa Pro because I was there. And we also, of course, talked about the passing of John Meadows since this just happened yesterday. So I'll put the link to that as well below in the descriptions of this podcast. All right. So anyways, the Tampa Pro was a great show. Ian Valeri was the winner. Ian won the New York Pro last year, and he trained very hard. If you follow this guy on Instagram, he's trains extremely, extremely heavy, and he's a beast. And he kind of reminds me of Jay Cutler with his wide shoulders, real massive legs, and wasn't totally dialed in. Could have been a little bit more ripped, but it was good enough to win, and he beat a really tough lineup. And so he will be going back to the Mr. Olympia this year, which will be 2 months on October, I believe. Let me see the dates here. October 7th, it will start, which is a Thursday, and will end on the 10th, which is that Sunday. So it'll be in Orlando. So I hope all you guys out here in the Florida area, or if you're traveling, can come and see that. I was hanging out with Sean Ray this weekend, and Sean is going to bring me on board again to do some coverage of the Mr. Olympia, hopefully some backstage interviews. So I'm very excited about that. I had a fun time doing that last year, and I'd love to come back and do it again. So, yeah, very good show, Tampa Pro. So, like I said, check out my report on digitalmuscle.com. All right. So let's get to some of these emails. I did get a couple emails from last week. This one says, "Hey, John, I just want to say your podcast is so entertaining and enjoyable as I grew up following the bodybuilders in the 80s. My love of the sport started after seeing Sean Ray on the cover of Flex magazine. And the first page I opened was a black and white picture of Lee Haney doing the arm stretched out pose. I couldn't believe his arms were as tall as his head. I was sold on bodybuilding, and within a year, I competed in an under 18 show for WABA. We were lucky enough to have an amazing gym called Progress House in Essex, UK, which was run by Mr. Universe Jim Connor and his amazing family. We witnessed greats like Albert Beckles performing a seminar, and I still can't forget Gary Stetson training with lightweights but looking as big as a house. Also, Ian Harrison, Sean Davis, and Charles Claremont also visited and trained at the gym. Again, I'll never forget witnessing Ian Harrison doing tricep pushdowns with the whole stack plus a plate first thing on a Sunday morning after only a couple of warm-up sets. Amazing days, and it felt like our own Gold's Gym with the atmosphere and energy that the Connors created for everyone. I'm now 48, and I regularly train and have made some really good gains, 100% natural like yourself. I still feel I haven't reached my potential, and I have found that once a week, all-over training works the best for me to recover and then grow. I make sure that my workouts are 100% focused and intense, like one of my favorite bodybuilders, Mike Mentzer. Anyway, keep up the amazing work, and I can't wait for your next podcast. I'm loving the anniversary shows, which I'm currently listening to part three. I hope you read my email, and I look forward to hearing from you. All the best, and keep up the amazing work. I've attached a couple of shots to show where my development is as I type this. Best regards and big respect for your incredible achievements in the sport, Stu. All right. Thank you, Stu. I always love hearing from my foreign listeners all the way out there in England and the UK. So thank you very much for listening. And you look really good, Stu. I checked out your pictures that you sent me. Thanks again for listening. And great memories there, man. That sounded like an awesome gym. All those pros coming in there and training. And like you said, you had your own little Gold's Gym there. This one I got, it said, "Hi, my name is Anita Green. My dad's name was Neville Green. He's from Trinidad and Tobago. His birthday was February 22nd, 1934. He was Mr. Trinidad and Tobago, I believe, in 1968. He also entered the Mr. World Cup and the Mr. Universe. I saw only one picture of him, but I can't find him on the internet anywhere. I have personal pictures, though, I'll attach to the email." So, Anita, yeah, I looked up your dad's name in the NABBA universe and also the IPV universe, but I couldn't find him anywhere. But his name does kind of sound familiar. So if any of our listeners out there have any information on Neville Green, or if you have any pictures, I know a couple people on Facebook and Instagram that are real big bodybuilding aficionados, and some of them have a great collection of pictures in their computer, so I can ask them as well. But I couldn't find out where he competed. Of course, the Mr. Trinidad and Mr. Tobago are not listed on the internet, but I'll keep looking for that Mr. Universe. I don't know if she's talking about the NABBA universe or the IFBB universe or which one, but I was not able to find Neville Green listed in the placings anywhere. So, but she did send a picture of him, and he looked really good. But I guess she's looking for more pictures. So if any of our listeners out there know anything about Neville Green, in 1968, he was in the Mr. World Cup and Mr. Universe, please let me know, and I will pass it on to Anita. All right, I also got one review of our Apple podcast. If you guys listen to our show, our podcast on Apple Podcasts, you can go on there and leave us a review. I really appreciate that. This one comes all the way from Ireland. It says, "I love this show. I love listening to John and his different guests each week, some who I know of and some I'm still just learning about. Very motivating for me when I don't feel like I can fulfill my own personal goals. I love to have it on at work when I can. Thank you, Tim, via Apple Podcast in Ireland." So thank you for listening, Tim, all the way out in Ireland. And if any of you guys have anything you want to share with me via email, you can send your emails to naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right, so that's all I got for our opening. Here is part two of our interview with Mark Martinez, where we talk about his upcoming documentary about the golden era of bodybuilding called Dream Big. Here we go. I was just watching Bob Costas has a new show on HBO, and I was just watching it today. And they had this girl on, and she's a reporter, a sports reporter. And she was talking about how younger people interpret the mass media or the social media today.
Right.
And I did this, they did this survey, and they asked these athletes, they said, if you could win this competition or get 20,000 new viewers on your YouTube channel, which one would you choose? They had to think about it.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Because it was like almost more important to get the 20,000 new viewers on your YouTube than it was to win the competition. And these are athletes.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you've seen it. You've seen it in Instagram and Facebook and YouTube, where you don't even have to be a competitor anymore, right? You could just be a guy or a girl.
And that personality. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And exactly. You're like, hey, you know, I'll sell you my training program, and they're making money, you know, whereas back in the day, even the, you know, if the competitors, if they didn't win a contest, they would make their money by probably being personal trainers if that's what they wanted to stay in.
Yeah.
And I know there was a few guys at Golds and then later on at Worlds that became kind of like the first generation of celebrity trainers.
Mm-hmm. That's what, you know,
Yeah. And that was how they made their money versus now. Yeah. You could be anybody on Instagram. And if you have a great body, you're an expert and you're selling your supplements or your courses or your whatever. Yeah. Yeah.
I seen two guys last night at the gym I was working out late, and they were about in their 20s, you know, and the one guy had his shirt off and he just didn't have much of a physique. You know, you could tell it was all about the social media aspect of it. And they're filming each other with their phones and they're over doing like just light cable curls, you know, nothing heavy duty, but it was all about, let's film this, let's put this on our social media, not about the workout. The workout was there, you know? So it's all about the filming of it and promoting themselves on social media. So I mean, Frank Zane would be going crazy, because I remember he wouldn't even talk to anybody back in the day. And these people are on their phones after every set. I mean, you know, Frank used to always talk about how the focus had to be there on the workout. And I remember Jerry Branham told me a story where Frank went to go get a drink at the water fountain. He was coming back and Jerry asked him a question about low carbs. And Frank goes, make an appointment with me. Talk to me after the workout. You know, he just totally cut him off. And Jerry went crazy, went nuts in it, because I guess he was eating low carb diet and he just lost his mind and he started screaming at Frank. But that's how Zane was, because Zane would not even talk to people, you know, during his workout, because he wanted to stay so focused on the workout. And now these people are not only just talking to people, they're on their phones, they're watching YouTube videos, they're texting. I mean,
the
concentration is totally off, you know.
I can imagine Jerry losing it, because him and Frank were neighbors. You know, it's not like I'm just a guy. Well,
that's why he took it so personally, because Frank just cut him off.
Yeah.
You know, plus he was dieting on low carbs anyway, so he was on the edge. But you know, he was so pissed that Frank wouldn't even talk to him. But that's how you have to look at Frank's point of view. That's how he looked at it. You know, he was just that focused, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It was his job. And again, getting back to like personalities, you know, there's guys with great physiques that maybe haven't competed ever or haven't competed in a long time, but they basically charge people to work out with them, and people do.
Yeah.
You know, so it's get that. Yeah. That's just another aspect. Could you imagine, like, you know, you were going for your natural Mr. Olympia and you're like, you're training with four guys because you're charging them. And it's like, I don't know how you could concentrate.
No.
You know, they want to train with John Hansen and you know, they're paying for it, but then you're like, well, I can't get my work done here.
Right. Or even filming the workouts. Yeah. Like, how do you have a workout when you have to film it? You know?
Yeah.
I just want to focus on the workout. I don't want to film it unless you hire somebody to film it, I guess. Yeah, I guess that's how they do it.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the movie, Mark. So you said that, I didn't know that you saw the Bill Grant interview and he couldn't think of Larry Gordon's name. So then is that where the original idea for the movie came from?
Yeah. I'd been kicking around an idea for a while to do something, a short documentary. And of course I always thought, like, well, outside of bodybuilding and bodybuilders, who cares, you know, cause I initially, wanted to do something on Mensur, and, only cause he was just such an interesting character. Yeah. And then reading about, I mean, it's just again, because it's an age thing and people that weren't there or didn't know somebody, I'm always amazed at how flippantly they speak about people, you know, that they have. And it's like I probably told you before, I remember I call him the world on a string mic, you know, because he was Joe's golden boy. He became editor of Muscle, muscle builder. He'd won the Mr. Universe. He was odds on favorite to win the Olympia. And it was like, and then within a couple of years, you know, those things happen. And all of a sudden, you know, he's out of the limelight. He's dealing with some health issues. And, you know, people make flippant comments. So I thought, you know, that's kind of, I wouldn't necessarily call it a fall from grace. I think when people understand mental health, they'd be a bit more empathetic about it. But I kicked that idea around. And then it was like, yeah, probably a couple years later, more than a couple years later, when I saw your interview with Bill Grant, and Bill, you know, was talking about, you know, he lived off Wilshire, I think on 6th Street. Okay. And he goes, and I had, and it was funny because he says a lot of people thought he was Mensur, because Larry Gordon, if you looked at Larry Gordon, looked like Mike Mensur with the glasses and the mustache and heavily muscled guy. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, wait a minute, you know, here's bodybuilding coming back into my life again. I was there, you know, and I have the skills from the video production end of it. And then I have the experience of actually being there. I'll combine the two.
Yeah.
And then again, it started initially as a shorter documentary about the 1977 Mr. America Parade. And it just kind of grew from there, you know, because I kept getting interviews and then it kept getting deeper and deeper. And, you know, one thing when I look at documentaries or even TV programs, and people want to like depict an era, and they'll use like the most popular, like they didn't really go too deep into research, right? Mm-hmm. You know, that let's, you know, whatever. They'll say, oh, let's go to the 80s and let's pull out a Madonna song or a Boy George song and then get some fashion and then we're done. You know, and that really just bothers me when I am like, you know, you have to go deep if you really care, if you really care about your subject matter.
Right.
And clearly I do. So it just got deeper and deeper with more guys. And I'm like, oh, my God, the list is growing. It's gone from 5 to 10 to 13 to I have to count my audio tracks. I think I've got 16 different interviews.
Okay.
You know, and
who did you start with, Mark? Like Ken Sprague and Bill Grant, the guys
who were the
parade.
Yeah, right? because it was initially about the 77 Mr. America parade. I'm like, okay, yeah. Well, Ken was the owner of the gym. He organized the parade.
Right.
Bill Grant was in it. Ken Waller was in it. Dave Dupuy was in it. Rudy was in it.
Right.
Tony Pearson was in it. So 5 of them I interviewed all at once up here in Northern California. I interviewed Tony in Las Vegas along with Wayne Gallish and Pete Samra, because I had contacted them and Wayne's like, you know, because I purchased the footage that Wayne had shot from the parade.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize Wayne shot some footage from the parade.
Yeah, he was there and he shot some footage and he says, I'm actually going to be in Las Vegas. And I said, well, Tony lives in Las Vegas. Pete Samra lived in Arizona. He was Pete won a couple of drug-free titles.
Yeah,
he was a Gold's Gym manager, and he was actually the guy who signed me up when I officially joined as a member. And so those were kind of like, I think, the core eight. Some other guys, you know, Kent Keene was a guy that wasn't sure. And then he says, okay, I'm ready. And then he called and he says, you know what? I'm having eye surgery. And I don't want to be, I go, I get it. I totally get it. You don't, you know, you wouldn't look good on camera and you'd probably be uncomfortable. So we'll wait. And then we waited. And then he changed his mind like a year later. And then sadly his health went down and then he passed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
he was a great guy. He was always very encouraging. And, you know, like you said, he encouraged you.
Yeah.
You as a teenager. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. And he was, you know, I've met people that said, oh, I remember writing Gold's Gym a letter. You know, because, you know, Kent was in the magazines as well, right? He was over 40, Mr. USA, over 40, right. Mr. America.
Right.
And it's kind of funny. We look back now, if you were in the magazines in that era and there was an article about you, it becomes immortalized, right?
Yeah.
It just becomes, I was just thinking, I was down in Santa Monica a few weeks back and I'm walking down the 3rd Street promenade and there's a building there that was the place where Ken Waller took Danny Padilla after Danny had won the amateur Mr. America, the AFAB. Yeah.
Right.
And
they went to eat.
Yeah, exactly. And when Danny was telling you, like, I never really went out and partied much. And I'm thinking, it shows you the power and the reach of the magazines, because if that was a one-time event, to you and I and all the millions of guys reading it, it was like, oh, Waller and Danny went out and all these guys and they partied. And it becomes immortalized. It lives forever.
Right.
You know, it lives forever. Like
my interview with him, I said, so you went out and partied a lot with Ken Waller, right? And he goes, no, just that one time, you know, because I didn't really go out and party. I'm like, because I was always thinking, oh, they were doing this all the time, you know, because I read that one article. You're right.
Yeah. And you know, you find that out. I tried to get Danny, but, you know, at the time, I think he's just like, I don't know who this guy is, or I don't remember this guy.
Yeah, and he was tough for me to get to interview.
Was he? Yeah.
Literally years. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a shame because, you know, Danny was hilarious.
He's a great storyteller. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I remember one time, at the end of the documentary, I have this photo of me in gold. It appeared in Muscle Builder, and it's Joe Weider and Mike Mentzer in the foreground. And my friend Scott in New York a couple of years ago, he emails me an attachment. He goes, "Is this you?" And I looked at it and I'm like, "Oh my God, that's me." Holy cow. You know, how did I miss that? You know, I bought every Muscle Builder. I'm like, you know, and I recognized some of the guys in the background standing around because we were all obviously all looking at Mike Mentzer and Joe Weider, and Craig Dietz took those photos, and they also took photos of Danny around the same time. You know, but it's just, you know, those things just stick with you. They just, they're immortalized forever.
Yeah.
You know?
So at what point did you decide, well, I'm going to make this more about, you know, the whole era instead of just the parade?
Yeah, I think when I got more guys involved, you know, I reached out, you know, I knew the history. So I reached out to guys. Some guys never answered. Some wanted to get paid. It was odd because, you know, I knew Rick Drayson from World Gym, mm-hmm. is where I met Rick in the late 70s. But at first he didn't want to be interviewed. And then when he saw a rough cut that I cut of the Gold's Gym t-shirt of Waller and Sprague talking about it, and then he emails me and he goes, "Where's my interview?" And I said, I've asked you, let's, you know, you're the guy that did it. So it kind of went like that. Like,
did you get to interview Rick?
Oh yeah. Rick, fantastic interview. And I think when guys would start talking about the original gym, and they would start, it's like when someone references someone else, then you're like, ah, now I have to go get that person. And when I spoke with John Balick, you know, because I used to see John at Gold's Gym on Second. He was a photographer, and when John was talking about the summer he spent with Arnold. And it had to be like 72 or so when Gaines and Butler came out west, and pitched it to Arnold.
Yeah.
And then my thought is, if I want to do this right, and I know how important the book Pumping Iron was to our whole canon of history, that I'm going to have to try and approach George Butler and Charles Gaines. And of course, George Butler was, he's not in a condition, you know, he's ill and has been ill for many years, but Charles, I think you're the one, I think you told me, he's receptive again to speaking about it. Cause for a while he wasn't, was what I heard. Charles was wonderful. I'm like, okay, well, Charles is going to talk a lot about Arnold and Franco.
Yeah.
And, you know, cause the initial was 77 and the parade initially, I wasn't going to ask Arnold anyway, cause he was already retired and a member of World at that time. But, you know, Rick says, "I could get you Franco, you know," and I'm glad I'm glad I did. So glad I did. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And,
so you got Rick Drayson, you got Franco, and both of those guys have passed now. And since you started this project,
I know. Yeah, it's just really sobering. I remember talking to Rick when Franco had passed, because I'd actually texted Lynn Swanson, who was Franco's press relations person. She kind of took care of all his business affairs, and I texted Lynn because I heard on the internet that Franco had passed. And I'm like, I really don't believe it. I'll text her, and she's like, wish it wasn't true. We're here in Italy right now, and we've been at the hospital all day.
Wow.
So, you know, I texted Rick, and then Rick and I spoke, I think, the next day, and he's like, "God, if that was one guy that I thought was going to live forever out of all of us, it would have been Franco." You know, I mean, I was just thinking, you know, I think when Rick interviewed me on Rick's Corner, and this was off camera, but I go, "You know what?" I go, "You know, Franco grew up in Sardinia. He probably never even had sugar till he got to Germany." You know, like they said, he was just nothing but natural food, strong as a bear. And just, that's why he was so, he could get so shredded. He just probably never had any sort of refined food base ever until we got to to you know, a bit further north in Europe.
Yeah, he looked like that kind of physique too. He looked like he was just really hard and muscular all the time, you know.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so yeah, so I got them, got Charles Gaines, and then Manny.
What did Franco talk about, Mark, when you were talking to him? How far did you guys talk about, like, his whole story and everything?
Yeah, you know, I got the backstory of him, because there are some guys that I do weave it in, you know, and I'm in my first rough cut, I'm like, okay, this is too long. This has got to be culled down. And I think Franco's backstory was initially maybe 2.5 minutes. And I'm like, I'm going to have to cut that down.
Hmm.
Even though it's Franco, it's like, we really got to tighten these things up, because you're looking at the timeline and it's growing and growing. And I think, you know, right now the movie, it's without closing credits is almost 90 minutes. It's about an hour, 20 something minutes.
Yeah.
And that's me cutting out some stories, like, okay, what doesn't really move? What can kind of be boring to some people, you know, because I kind of wanted to do it in a general audience sort of way, even though it's couched in bodybuilding. I wanted to kind of like bring in 1970s Southern California, Venice, Santa Monica, and the culture at large. And so I'm like, maybe some things will be on outtakes or something else. Yeah. But frankly,
are you in charge of the editing yourself, Mark?
Yeah, I am. I mean, I'm a one man band. That's another reason it's taken a long time, is I shot, you know, I've had a couple people help me as a second camera person. I had a guy that I met, really nice guy named Dan Perales, and he was head of the video department at an aviation company down in Southern California. Mm-hmm. So I finally get Pete Grimkowski and Manny Perry to say yes on the same weekend. So I fly down to Long Beach Airport, but before I do, I'm like looking for my camera and I'm like, where's my camera?
Yeah.
And my son, who was down in college in Santa Barbara, had it. And I'm like, great.
Yeah.
But this is how things happen. I had this one guy had contacted me from Rick's Corner. It was a guy named Dan Perales. And Dan's like, hey brother, we're the same age. He goes, I used to ride my bike to Gold's. I remember getting Roger Callard and Ken Waller's autograph. He goes, I used to see him play handball out at the weight pit.
Yeah.
And he told me what he did. And he goes, if you ever need help, I said, the matter of fact, Dan, I kind of do. And he's like, no problem. He goes, I have a couple cameras, I have monitors, I have lights. So that one to me was a joy, because one, he was just a great guy, an absolute pro. And I was like, I can't reschedule. You know, Pete's not going to say yes again. Manny's busy.
Right.
And so it was better than I could imagine. You know, it was like, you know, sometimes the angels come forth.
Yeah.
That's crazy. So, and then I'm trying to think, I think those were probably my last two, and maybe Franco after that, because we had to wait for Franco to get back from Italy. When Lynn said,
what year did you interview Franco?
It was 2018, because he died in 2019.
Yeah. A year later.
And it was, in fact, it was August of 2018. And, my friend Scott was
right around his birthday, didn't he?
To almost a year to the day later. Yeah. Okay. And, you know, there was a time when I thought Arnold was going to get involved. I was speaking to a couple guys over at Oak Productions, but you just realized they just kind of like, you know, placate people. I'm sure I was probably getting vetted behind the scenes too, where it was like, oh, this is a tiny project, I'm not going to get involved in that.
Yeah.
You know? Exactly. You know, so, you know, you understand that, but
Arnold, I think at this point, wants to talk about bodybuilding anymore. Or do you think he's on to other things? Like I know he's a big advocate of the climate control and stuff like that.
Yeah. And he's got the Schwarzenegger Institute, for, I think, political and social studies at USC, where a few of his kids went to USC. I know one went to Georgetown, but I've been told, because John Balick was talking to Lynn Marks, who was Arnold's longtime assistant. Like Lynn's been with him since like the Stay Hungry days, in a different capacity. And John's like, you know, Mark, you know, it's the history. I think Arnold needs to be involved.
Yeah.
I haven't spoken to him since before, but I know Lynn, and maybe Lynn can get some clips to him. So Lynn saw it and she goes, you know, I sent some clips and I went heavy on the Franco interview.
Yeah.
To try and jog the sentimental part. And Lynn got back to John and I and said, you know, I find it very interesting, but the governor doesn't want to talk about those days anymore.
Oh, man.
And that's, I'll tell you off camera, off the interview, what transpired after that, but I'm kind of sworn to secrecy just out of respect to some other producers that are working on another project.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, who can blame them? I mean, it's, you know, we look at the photo, it's like when we listen to music, you know, we always think that that artist is going to be, the Beatles are always going to be Sgt. Pepper. And, but it's like people get older, people pass away. Same with any rock group or anything, yeah. Or it's even a celebrity, you know, when you see them out in public and people go, wow, you got old. It's like, well, you're looking at a film that's 40 something years old. I mean, yeah, right. I'm human. I'm going to get older too.
Right.
And I think Arnold, yeah, it's like, you know, been there, done that, you know, a million times. And
Yeah. When I think about, I mean, I understand, but I just wish Arnold would do an interview about bodybuilding because, you know, we're seeing all these people pass away, you know, Ed Corney, Franco, Rick Drayson, all the time. They're just passing away. You know, I wanted to get Jimmy Caruso on the on the podcast, you know, because I heard he was still operating his gym in Montreal, but I knew he had to be super old because he looked old in the 70s, you know. And I guess in his 95, I think he was.
Yeah.
And then I heard he just passed away. I'm like, man, this happens all the time to me on this podcast. I try to get these people, then I hear they pass away, and it's just so frustrating.
Yeah, it is.
Because when they die, their stories die with them, you know? And I mean, you can know, obviously we all know the history of Arnold, but I'd like to hear the stories from Arnold, you know? I mean, his point of view, you know?
Right, exactly. Yeah, well, what happened that day at the Germans? What happened the day they were laying out? What happened? Well, I mean, I'll tell you one story. I have it on, it's not in the movie, but Franco was recounting a time that, and this was previous to any of Arnold's bigger movies. He'd already done Stay Hungry and obviously The Doc Pumping Iron.
Yeah.
But Dino De Laurentiis was, they were at his office in Beverly Hills and Dino De Laurentiis had said, yeah, you know, and he was European. So you'd think he'd be a bit more open to Arnold and the fact that, you know, he had an accent and a quote unquote funny name.
Yeah.
But he said, you're not right for this part. Like, you know, who are you joking? You know, go back to the gym. And he goes, I saw Arnold just like lose it. Like he just like stood up and like, he's, you know, who are you to speak to me like that, you tiny little man? And Franco laughing as he's telling the story. He's like, you know, he goes, Arnold, he goes, I didn't know what, I thought he was going to pick up the desk and throw it out the window on Wilshire Boulevard. You know, he goes, you know, that was like the side of Arnold that I think he got really better at playing his cards close to the vest, you know, but I'm sure at some point you're like, I'm just so tired of being second guessed and doubted and discounted and I'll show all of you, you know?
Yeah. Right.
But that was funny, you know, cause Franco was laughing as he was remembering it. I thought De Laurentiis turned white as a sheet. He goes, I thought I was going to have a heart attack right there in the chair.
Yeah. The story I heard was that Dino never met Arnold. And I read this in a couple books about Arnold, that his agent, you know, brought Arnold in to a meeting with Dino De Laurentiis. Right. And Dino De Laurentiis was a little guy and he was sitting behind this huge like desk, like in The Godfather, you know?
Right.
And the first thing Arnold said was, why does such a little guy need such a big desk? And then Dino De Laurentiis had never heard Arnold talk. So then he heard the accent and he goes, you have an accent. You can't be flat. Cause he was supposed to be Flash Gordon. He was trying to.
Right. Oh, okay. That was
cool. Flash Gordon, not Conan. And he goes, how are you going to be Flesh of Gordon with an accent? And Arnold goes, I have an accent. I can't even understand what you're saying. And that was it. The meeting was over in like 2 minutes.
Oh,
and walking out, and the agent told him, he goes, you just fucked up your whole career. And Arnold's like, no, it'll be fine. And sure enough, it was.
Yeah. Wow. Once Balick had mentioned Gaines, and that opened up that, then I knew it had to grow.
That's pretty much how far you start with them, Mark, right? You start with, you know, Charles Gaines and, you know, the whole Venice Beach scene in the early 70s.
Right. And actually, because, you know, guys like Rick and Bill Grant, Ken Sprague, Ken Waller, and Arnold, and Dave Dupree, when they talk about the early gym, they even go prior to when Charles Gaines had come out in 72. So even though that's kind of like a kicking off point, there is some references to at least the late 60s when all those guys had come out for the first time.
Yeah.
You know, Rick had come down from Bakersfield. Ken had come out from Cincinnati. Waller had come out from Kentucky. Okay. Actually, I think he came down from Canada because he was up there with the Toronto Argonauts.
Okay. I didn't know that.
Trying out, for Canadian football. And he's just like, he goes, when I started getting paid or I was going to get paid to play pro football. He goes, it wasn't fun anymore. He goes, and I didn't know if I really wanted to do that. And he,
that was the football team that Lou Ferrigno tried out for too, right?
That's right. The Argonauts. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
How was Ken Waller to talk to? Because I'm sure he had a ton of stories. I mean, being the manager of Golds and hanging out with Arnold. And
Yeah. Ken was he's a great guy. I mean, he's very, very private incredibly private. He did send me a photo a few months back when there was some flooding in Alabama, because that's where he's living now, along the Gulf Coast. And he says, I'm fine, but you know, this kind of happened near where I'm at. But yeah, he had all those guys, you know, had some great stories. And they're like, it's like, you know, walking through Venice back then, it was, there wasn't a whole lot of people around, and a lot of people don't realize it. You know, native Los Angelinos, or they'd stay away from Venice. You know, they'd be in Santa Monica, but they're like, I'm not going south of Rose Avenue on Main Street, because things get scary pretty quick, especially back then. You know, but you know, they were, you know, they scared people just by their appearance. You know, it's like, you know, Sprague had said it, and Waller had said it. He goes, there was a biker gang clubhouse that was in a house for a while right next to the original Golds. And he says, and they were scared of us. It's like, they would be walking down the street, and then when they got like close to Golds, they would cross the street and walk across.
Wow, you know? Really?
Yeah. And Franco said it too, because we would be out front, you know, and we'd come out to get some air, you know, after working out and getting pumped, and they would like look at us. He goes, and they were all dressed up in their chains and their knives hanging and their belts. He goes, and they looked at us like, God, stay away from those guys. Right. You know, so
because bodybuilders weren't well known back then. I mean, nobody had muscles back then, you know.
No reference point for someone the size of Ken Waller or Dave Dupree or
right
Bill Grant, Arnold.
Lifting all those heavy weights and everything, that'd be crazy.
Yeah.
So how's the movie? The movie is finished, right, Mark?
It is finished. And right now, and I'm QCing it. So I'm going, you know, quality checking, making sure that I've got my color correction and my sound mixing that I would have liked to have gotten done professionally by someone who does nothing but sound design or someone who does color correction. But I'm like, okay, I'm going to have to do the best job I can. Mm-hmm. And so I'm checking the lower thirds, the titles, make sure everything's spelled correctly. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to have to add the closing credits. But after that, then it's purchase the Arizona Emissions Insurance and then upload it to the other Venice Film Festival in Venice, California, and see if it gets accepted. And then enter it in some other ones. And then go from there, see if it garners any sort of interest.
Yeah.
And then if not, you know, I will, you know, upload it to Amazon or iTunes, Vimeo, probably behind a paywall.
Okay.
And kind of self-distribute, just like how people, you do your podcasts, or people put out their own music on SoundCloud or something. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a whole new ball game. So, you know, I'm hoping to get some interest. Obviously, you know, I put a lot of time and effort and money into it. Yeah.
Alex Ardente did that with his, do you see his Supps movie? SUP?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's selling.
Yes, I did.
On Amazon.
Yeah. Alex and I were, you know, he's taken photos of both my son and daughter, her for like a modeling portfolio.
Oh, okay.
She's a teenager. And then my son for his IMDb page, because he's a film major. And so he wanted some professional shots for his IMDb page. And then Alex and I were actually in a meeting together last October down in Venice, speaking to the head of marketing for Gold's Gym, because I wanted to see if there was interest in them investing in the movie. I'm like, this is your guys' history.
Yeah.
And this, you know, if you want to rebuild the brand, this is, I think, if I do say so myself, a pretty good movie about Gold's Gym that would only help you guys.
Yeah.
And then Alex was in the meeting too, because he was hoping to get to be kind of like the house videographer for him, you know, making content, training films or whatnot. And Ed Connors had set up that meeting for us. So Reiner Schallert, who owns Golds, he's the German guy that bought Golds.
Okay.
He was in the meeting with Ed's meeting, and then a guy named Yuse was head of marketing, and he met with Alex and I. but it was, you know, it's kind of a strange meeting. I mean, a nice guy, but it was, it just seemed kind of like an odd meeting. Like they didn't have any interest, but I was thinking, okay, well, you guys called the meeting, not us. So, you know,
they're not going to help a sponsor, or they're not going to help invest in it.
No. They had said that they had that they were working on their own documentary, which, you know, is totally understandable. And I think when I found that out, first thing I did when I got home, I was down in Venice and I drove down. And so I had to drive back up to Northern California. And the first thing I did was I got online to Library of Congress and uploaded rough cut of my movie and had it copyrighted, you know, just to protect myself.
Sure.
It's like, okay, it's Library of Congress. Here's the title. Here's the content of it, even though it's in rough cut form, and I'm covered, you know, that way. So,
have you had investors, Mark, or has this been all out of you?
No, well, I had a life coach, a gentleman named Mike Murphy, and he helped give me the initial seed money to fly guys out and get them interviewed, rent a studio, and he also, you know, he lives in Colombia part of the year, and so he's down in Colombia. He runs something called Mountains of Hope, and it's a meditation center, but it's also a place where women who are dealing with cancer and don't have the funds to take care of their care or get care. And then he owns a couple of car dealerships that his sons run, but he's done a lot. I mean, all I can say is, you know, anything that he gave me, this project would have never gotten off the ground without that. And that's when it became a real project, because I all of a sudden had some money to write checks and get guys out, and, you know, because you have to put them up in a hotel for a couple of days, fly them out, feed them.
Yeah.
You know, so, and then beyond that, it's been just myself, what I could do by myself or money I could pull out. And then, of course, like with the GoFundMe, some, you know, people have been kind enough to send some money in, and that will be used for the insurance.
Yeah. Now, what is that, errors and omissions? You mentioned that a couple of times, the insurance errors and omissions.
Yeah. It's like, you know, when you watch a movie and you see credits, and then you'll see like at the end, it'll say like insurance. You're like, what the heck? And it's, there's, you know, obviously insurance for people that get injured or hurt or, God forbid, killed on set. Okay. But then there's also errors and omissions insurance. That is basically to protect yourself against, you know, misstatement of facts or slander, libel, anything like that. Or people that will say, oh, you know what? I didn't give you permission to use my image, but that's why you have release forms. Because everyone in the movie that I've interviewed obviously knew they were being interviewed and signed a release form.
Yeah.
But you just never know. I mean, when I was going over this with my lawyer, and he's like, yeah, you know, it's funny. He says, I've had cases where someone will say, well, that's a picture of me sitting on the credenza behind that person. You know, it's like a little tiny, but someone will do that, you know? And, so it's, you know, you gotta cover yourself.
Yeah. So. That's interesting. I wonder if Pumping Iron Head, did they have investors or did they just fund that themselves?
No, they did. There was a guy named
company, right? White Mountain Films that did it, right?
Yeah. There's a gentleman named Jerome Gary.
I
don't know if Dave McVeigh may have mentioned him in your interview, but he was a guy in California that was like, you know, you're talking, you know, middle 70s. He was like the waterbed king. He had made his money that way is what I understood. But he wanted to get in films. And so he was one of the guys that Butler was able to recruit and get some seed money. Okay. And then, of course, you've also heard the story where George Butler said I was probably the most important person to American Express because they called me 50 times a day.
Because I remember how he was charging for that. You know, and then they did the thing at the Whitney Museum to try to get some money to fund it, you know, because they were behind.
Right. And that helped. And that, you know, that was another thing, I think, because obviously it's about the 75 contest, but the movie wasn't finished or released till 77.
Yeah, January 77, right.
Yeah. And Charles Gaines had told me, too, that George's mother-in-law helped kick in some money.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much, but it was like, you know, he goes, it was almost like the book, you know, where Charles said, you know, even though he was a published author and had won awards and whatnot, he goes, to do that sort of book, no one was going to publish it. They're just like, you can do anything but that. Yeah. Don't do that.
Right.
And like he said, he goes, it was almost, because I'd given up on it because I just got tired of being told no by people that I had connections with.
Yeah.
And he said it was kind of like for George, the same thing with the movie, because even though Charles wrote the book, George made the movie of the book.
Yeah.
But he said, yeah, it's like, you know, after a couple of years, you're thinking, wow, is this ever going to happen? Because we just kept getting doors slammed in our face. And
it's unbelievable because it was such a great book. The photos are great and the writing was great. And it was about a difference. I mean, I know the subject was probably considered weird, bodybuilding, but they covered it so well and they did such a great job with it. I can't believe, you know, a publisher wouldn't say, wow, let's take a chance on this, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I know, you know, they both had connections in publishing. Yeah. You know, George was he may have already done a couple of other documentaries. I'm not sure.
And then Charles wrote Stay Hungry, which won some book award, right? Like book of the year or something. Yeah. He won like his very first novel. He won an award.
Yeah. And he was a freelance writer writing for Argosy magazine, Field and Stream, Sports Illustrated, Vanity Fair, you know, a lot of big magazines. So it wasn't like he was.
And then they decided to make a movie out of his book. I mean, how often does that happen? You know,
I know. And twice.
Yeah. Right.
You know, so yeah, that's been the financial situation on it. So, and you know, and Charles had told me one time, cause you know, I'll keep in contact with them and via email, but you know, he's like, if you finish, you win, you know, I know that's easy for me to say.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, things, obviously a couple things that he had done, he goes that I never thought I'd ever be associated with or thought would ever amount to anything, you know, bodybuilding, where he did really well with the book Pumping Iron. And then he was actually with his friend, the co-creator of Paintball. And he goes, and all of a sudden I'm getting this big, gigantic check written to me, you know, because this thing had taken off, you know, doing paintball. He goes, and those are two things I didn't wake up and when I was a writer at, you know, University of Iowa Masters of Fine Arts Workshop, thinking I was going to be the creator of paintball or write a book about bodybuilding. It's like,
right.
You know, and those were, you know, two things that contributed a lot to his life.
Yeah. So the GoFundMe thing you have going on now, that's to help pay for the insurance and get this thing finally finished. Yeah.
Right. If there's any gravy left over from the insurance, which runs a little over 4,000. I'm probably at about high 3,000s now for the fundraiser. Then anything else will probably go into what I can get done color correction wise or audio mixing. But I kind of have a feeling that I'll be doing that. I mean, I've been doing it as I've been combing through it. I'm just okay. Every time I make a pass through the movie, and Alex had told me this, he says, you know, he goes, when I was getting my movie ready for, I think it was iTunes or Amazon, he said, and it's like, oh my God, I've seen this movie like 500 times. How did I miss that? He goes, and there'd be like some little flash frame of black or a missed transition or something. And he's like, I know the feeling because I'm like, the other night I had changed the font on the lower thirds, the identifiers for the guys. And I'm going through checking to make sure they're spelled correctly and they say what I want them to say. And I'm like, oh, there's a couple that I forgot that are still in the old font. How did I miss that? I've been combing through this.
Yeah.
You know, myriad amount of times, you know,
I'll put the link for the GoFundMe on this video and then
in the
descriptions below. So hopefully people will help contribute.
Yeah. I'll send a few outtakes too, that you could cut into the interview if you want. Yeah.
Yeah. So when is the Venice Film Festival then?
It is October 1st through 3rd. And I have to have it submitted by middle of September.
Okay.
Is the late submission. So, you know, it's finished now and just have to get the closing credits and keep QCing and then upload it and hope for the best.
Are there any other film festivals you're looking at too, Mark?
You know, I haven't, only because just given COVID over the past year where things have been canceled or the time frame, I've just been focused on this one. And then also too, just because of the location, it just seems like a perfect
perfect fit. You got
Although I don't know if you've ever interviewed James Hergott. He did the movie From Fat Lolly to Six Pack Lolly, but James is he's done some films and he's a fitness expert and very well built guy. MMA, he might be a good interview. But he had told me, he says, you know, there were some film festivals that I thought my movie would be perfect for that I got turned down. He goes, and there were other ones that I sent in like, they're never going to call me, and they got accepted. Mm. He said, so you know, as much sense as it would make for Venice to accept it, because it kind of Yeah, because you know, you just never know. I'm not saying that to dissuade you. You know, obviously enter it as many times as you can.
Yeah,
wherever you want. Because but just because it's life's funny that way. You know. Yeah. So,
what about the big ones like Sundance and like Tribeca and you know the one? I think those are in the beginning of the year though, aren't they usually?
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I will. I don't. I've been so focused on just getting this thing out. You know, it's. Yeah. I was talking to Chris Bell.
Yeah.
Who did Bigger, Stronger, Faster and Prescription Thugs and Trophy Kids. And like he said, because my first movie, which was Bigger, Stronger, Faster, he said, I was lucky. I had a crew. I had a budget. I had a crew.
Yeah.
And he goes, so he was, I didn't have to worry about chasing down the insurance. There was someone for that. He was, there had someone who was in, who he was, I would edit, but then there was like the finishing editor, the online editor.
Yeah.
There was the people doing the music score. There were the people checking on the clearance on the music and on the film clips. You know, so he goes, I didn't have to worry about any of that, you know? And so I go, that's great to have. I hope to have that for my next film, you know, right. But he goes, but another thing too, he goes, and then depending on the film festival, he goes, some, you need representation, you know, they're not going to take a submission unless you have a talent agent. So it's like, this is your first film, you know, and I know Netflix doesn't take any films unless you're going through a lawyer that has an established contact with Netflix. They don't just take unsolicited submissions.
Yeah, otherwise they take millions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, everyone would upload. Yeah, right.
Wow.
So
okay. Well, hopefully I'm gonna try and get out there to Venice and see that. I'd love to go to the film festival with you.
No, that'd be great. That'd be great.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, right. Because yeah. This has been a labor of love for you for what now, 6 years, right?
Yeah. If you had told me that when I started, I probably wouldn't have started.
Yeah, right.
You know.
Well, best of luck to you, Mark, and great job on finally coming to the end. And like Charles Gaines said, you won because you finished it. So
that's it.
I can't wait to see it. And hopefully it'll get a really good reception from the bodybuilding world, you know?
Yeah, I hope so.
All right, thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you to Mark Martinez for joining us to talk about his documentary. And of course, I will keep all you guys posted on when that movie will be released and what's going on with it as we get closer to that Venice Film Festival in October. And like I told Mark, I'm going to try and make it out there to California to see if I can attend that festival and see his film when it first gets shown. I'm really excited about that. All right, I want to thank Florida Alternative Medicine for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank again all our Patreon donors for contributing to the show every month. If anyone out there is interested in becoming a Patreon donor, just go to our official website, which is bodybuildinglegendshow.com. And in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see how you also can become a Patreon donor if you so wish. And like I said, if you guys have any emails that you want to send me, just send them over to naturalolympia@gmail.com. I always love hearing your comments and your thoughts on the show and any guests you want to hear from or anything you want to share with me. All right. So let me go and read our article of the week. This article comes from the May 1979 issue of Joe Weider's Muscle Builder and Power magazine. And it is from Frank Zane. And it's called, I'll Win Mr. Olympia a Third Time. Here's Why. It says, Zane dares once again to put his reputation on the block. His reliance on dreams is well known. He got the victory message early this year. With the affirmation of a positive attitude and the best Zane body ever put forward, he stands to be judged. Will his dream once again come true? Winning the Olympia title again is a matter of attitude, both mine and others. My attitude right now is that I've already won it a third time. I can't see any way that anyone could possibly beat me for this title again. I can now do things with my body in short periods of time if I need to. I can prepare quickly for any show. The only problem I have now is lack of time. For the next several months, I will be busy promoting my new book, The Zane Way to a Beautiful Body by Simon & Schuster. Both Christine and I will be touring the country. Naturally, my intention is to train as much as possible on the tour. Tours mean getting up at 6 a.m. for early radio shows, going to bookstores to sign autographs, TV shows and department stores in the afternoon, and more TV appearances in the evening. You might get to bed by 1 a.m. I try to reserve time for training periods, but you never know how much the promotion will escalate. Christine and I both want to make this book a smashing success, however, because we put a lot into it. I think it's the epitome of anything ever written on bodybuilding in the way of instruction. It has everything for the beginner to the competitive bodybuilder, plus the kind of training I have done to win contests. The promotion of the book is my present priority. The Olympia contest is 8 months away, but I have a heavy tour schedule from now until June. I hope to be able to devote all my time to training during the tour summer months prior to the contest. If I can do that, I will absolutely win. I know who I am up against right now. I know the guys who will be competing, their strong points and weak points. I have studied them closely, their photos, films, and live performances. I have been there with them, and I have watched them. I know there is nothing they can do to beat me. My competitors have criticized me in magazine articles, and I guess I would do the same if I had lost. It's human nature to get upset about such losses. First of all, there is no such thing as a perfect physique. Everybody has weak points. The longer I train, the more I realize that everybody will always have weak points. It is relative. I have never seen a physique that couldn't be improved. Maybe that's the challenge behind all of it, the very thing that intrigues me. Can I still improve my body? Can my body still get better? The best way for me to find out is to have competition, to train for a contest. What I am finding out right now is that in training for contest, it's important to stay near your best all year long. Years ago, I used to train hard only during the summer. I would get in shape for the fall show and then take it easy the rest of the year. Since I retired from teaching, I've been training hard all year long. Bodybuilding has become a true lifestyle for me. I've been staying in top shape throughout the year, and I can see that this is the better way of life. I have become more productive in other areas too. My 2-hour workouts every day keep me near my potential. The true fascination with training is finding out what you can do with yourself, but it always seems that competition is the primary motivation. It makes you train hard enough to realize this potential. I don't agree with this need for competition. Something inside me says you can develop the same condition without a contest for motivation. Is there anything that can possibly come from inside of me to make me achieve that condition? There is the external influence, the contest, the publicity, the money. What's inside of me that will get me into that condition besides a contest? That is the burning question in my mind right now. Getting back to the Olympia competition, there's the question of when I should stop competing. I don't think it really matters that I stop. If I don't enter the competition 1 year, that doesn't mean I won't enter the next year. I've often said the only reason I wouldn't enter the Olympic competition this year is if something better came up. I'm open to growth in other areas. I have reached the pinnacle of bodybuilding. However, if there is another avenue by which I can bring bodybuilding to the public, such as TV, movies, and related areas, I will certainly consider them. If I got a significant movie offer, I would accept it, even if it prevented me from training for the Olympia. There is always that chance, but that doesn't mean it would be the same way next year. Right now, I know for sure that I will win if I compete, and the reason for that is my attitude. I know what I have to do with my body this year. It has happened, and it is already happening. I have improved weak points since the last Olympia. People will criticize an area I was weak in this year, like my arms. I think my arms were very good this year, but I think they could have been better for the past several years were it not for my elbow problems. It's taken me 3 years to correct that. My elbows now feel better than ever. You could likely get perfect development if you didn't have injuries to hamper you. A certain movement in bodybuilding makes the muscle respond and grow in a certain way. It gets the muscle into a specific shape. For example, if you have an injury that prevents you from doing concentration dumbbell curls like I had for a long time, your biceps will not get an outer peak. For years, that was one of my problems. I didn't have that problem in 1974, and I was doing heavy concentration curls resulting in big biceps. My elbows felt good in 1977 also. It's different things in different years. I know enough about my past training at certain points and what I looked like at those points to develop a winning system. I've done this in the past few years, and I could do it even better this year. I think you can shape the outcome of any kind of athletic event if you have the right attitude. I'm not referring to normal attitudes like psyching out or anything like that. I'm talking about a certain state of mind that is reached prior to competition and held throughout the competition. There are different ways to create this state of mind, but I created the last week before a contest. You might call it faith mind. That's what it's called in certain texts that I've read. It's hard to describe the state in words because you no longer have a lot of language going through your mind. You reach a state of absolute serenity.
You don't have a voice in your head telling you what to do. You experience everything directly without words or concepts. If your attention is sustained long enough on one specific thing, then you pass into a state after a period of time. With intensive effort, that period of time might last 4 hours. Marathon runners manage to achieve that state. I can achieve that state through methods easier than running. I put them into use often, but they are in sharper focus the last week before a contest. Magical things happen in that state. There's no voice in your head telling you negative things. I have competed long enough to know what it's like that last week. You tend to fall apart. There are too many doubts and negative thoughts. Attitude becomes important at that time. I know that attitude. My manner and state of being at the time of the show was what made me win the last 2 years. You create all this yourself. Everything that you think can eventually become real, especially things that I say. They are already real in symbolic form. Since I have faith mind developed, it has already happened for me. It's so simple. It is difficult. As this article is being written, I have already won the Olympia. When you can cultivate this state of mind, you are also rewarded with indications in your life of how things will be for you in the future. Psychologist Carl Jung called it synchronicity. It is the simultaneous occurrence of two or more meaningful but not casually connected events. It is a coincidence in time of two or more casually unrelated events which have the same or similar meaning. In the Olympia contest, I had a lot of signs that pointed to victory. Some will claim that it is only imagination and coincidence. That's right, it is imagination, but it's meaningful coincidence. That's what synchronicity means. It's a sign that tells you to keep going and have faith in what you're doing. By doing so, you create the outcome you want. Preceding the Olympias that I've won, and even those that I've lost, I've had dreams that told me what would happen. Recently, I had my dream for this year. Last year, my dream that I would win the Olympia happened in June. It was a special kind of dream, more like an experience. It was so real, I could have been awake. I was in New York when I dreamed it. I was the only one in the contest, things like that. It was really a fantastic dream. I was driving with Arnold toward my home in Pennsylvania. At one point, Franco, who was also in the car, got out and walked into a graveyard. It was symbolic with meanings and associations tied up with metaphor and specific figures of speech that you use. There's always a theme for a dream. And what it symbolized, Franco walking up and over into a hill into a graveyard, was the death of my competition. Franco was the last one who could beat me. Before that, it was Arnold. Those were the two guys that had a chance of beating me. I don't think any of the current crop does. I know where they're at. There is a bunch of great professionals coming up. They keep getting better every year, and the competition is getting greater in every way. But the Olympia is a special kind of contest, the only contest I get in shape for, once a year. And I promise I will never enter it unless I am in better shape than I've ever been before. It is the ultimate challenge. I can't allow myself to only be as good as I was in the previous years. I have to be overall better. If I'm not, I won't go in it. When I do go in, I'm better than ever. I know that. And because of my attitude, everybody else knows it too. They will see it also. What this amounts to is that every bodybuilder has to come up with a system that lets him work with this, with his unconscious mind. Your conscious mind is smart, but your unconscious mind is smarter. Your unconscious mind is controlling everything. It is running you, other people, events, the entire world. You must get in touch with it. Let it come through you. Let yourself be moved by it. Bodybuilding has been perfect for me in developing such a system. And when you're able to do that, you transform your whole life. People ask me what my plans for the future are, and I tell them I don't make any plans. Every year I make New Year's resolutions, and by the end of the year I accomplish them. Other than that, I don't make plans. My life is led by meaningful coincidence. I've already had my dream this year about winning the Olympia. It was very clear. It occurred when some very significant things were happening. It happened in January, early, when a lot of changes were going on. I don't want to discuss the dream at this point, but its meaning unquestionably gave me the option of winning again. The contest is won in the final week of training. I'm sure of that. People who see me 2 weeks before a contest are willing to bet that I will never win it. All I need is the right environment. I start perfecting my posing at the end, practicing and becoming aware of how I look. I cultivate the right frame of mind. My training is different too. I want to round out the finished product rather than try for any great size. I've been learning every year. This year is no different. So every year I have more experience. I have more meetings at my disposal. For instance, now I have a private training headquarters. I can retreat to it for a month at a time and train. I can't do that at present because there are too many demands on my time. But every now and then I go there, and the workouts I get in 2 days are almost paralyzing. It's so different from training in a regular gym that I realize how much outside distraction there is in training publicly. When I'm in my private gym, my training is total, 2 or 3 hours. At a regular gym, there is an energy loss caused by interchanges, crossovers, and distractions. For me, a home gym is absolutely the best way to train. The problem is creating the environment in the home gym, the right attitude. I've had some very good home gyms, like the one I had in Florida, but I didn't have the right attitude. In the private gym I have now, I don't have to do anything else but train and lie in the sun. What a life. Money? No, I'm not that much interested in the money aspects of a contest. Money means a lot, of course, but for me, there are other ways to make money. I can't see getting stuck in the competitive syndrome my whole life. I really don't like competition that much, but I can see its purpose. It takes a lot of discipline to keep bodybuilding like this. The discipline you develop can be used to do anything else you may want to do. I maintain my 2-hour training ritual every day. It serves as the basis for all other activities. One of my goals is to keep getting better every day of the year and to stay that way. It becomes no strain because it happens in a most natural way. It still takes discipline to work out 2 hours every day and to keep many outside appointments as well. As I get older, I'm faced with a busier life than ever. My schedule has not eased up. I must learn to take this in stride to handle it all efficiently. If I had to enter a contest every 2 months, it would mean I couldn't do anything else. When you train for competition, you are totally exhausted every day. That has been my experience. That's the only way you can make gains. If I do that, I can't function well on other levels of activity. I may continue entering the Mr. Olympia for a long time to come yet. As a matter of fact, my latest dream was an indication of that. It gave me a nice option. That helps my attitude. It's good to know that I have the choice, and whatever way I go will be the best for me. I also feel a great responsibility toward bodybuilding. I was a teacher for many years, and I know all the right teaching techniques. My wife, Christine, was also a teacher. And between us, I think we can teach bodybuilding better than anyone. I have that option also. And one of the things I want to do in the future is put more time into this. In fact, students I used to teach in school are now training at the gym, and I find myself again telling them what to do. That's one of the reasons Christine and I wrote our book. It's a perfect teaching tool that any teacher could adapt to a classroom situation or a gym. We plan to use it as a teaching tool in our seminars. Bodybuilding is gradually unfolding for us. We've created the opportunities which we've given us many comfortable options. There is a considerable risk standing before a tribunal of bodybuilding judges. Your fate rests with their decisions. I train for perfection for everyone to see. When I am sure of what I am presenting, I see no risk. I welcome approval and I want it. My attitude should make it very clear that I have done my best, that I am at my best, and really that I intend to be at my best for a long time to come. All right. Great article by Frank Zane. I love reading these articles because you really get a sense of where their head is at that particular time in their life. And of course, Frank was already a 2-time Mr. Olympia winner, and he was training to win his 3rd title. And I was lucky enough to see Frank win all those 3 titles. And I can tell you that in 1979, he really did reach his peak. He was the best he ever looked. He was bigger. I believe he weighed 190 pounds. And he was very ripped and very, very ready in every way. His skin tone, his trunks, his posing, just everything was perfect. And if you read Frank's latest book, which was a really big book, I can't remember the title of it right now, but if you go to frankzane.com, you'll see it. It was the book that came out about 2 years ago. Frank talks a lot about that 1979 Mr. Olympia and how he trained for that contest, and especially the last month before the contest, when he was basically living in Palm Springs by himself and his wife, Christine, stayed at home at their other house and she was taking care of things. And Frank was just totally into this mental aspect of training. He did a lot of meditation, tanning out in the pool, training twice a day. His diet was right on point. And you can see that's why he was so mentally prepared when he went to the contest, because he just had everything worked out and he was so focused on this contest. It
was very, very motivating to read that. And it's very motivating to read articles like this to see the mental attitude that Frank had. And that's what I really miss about the bodybuilders of then compared to the bodybuilders of today. First of all, you don't get articles like this anymore because we don't have magazines. But it's really great to hear someone, a champion like Frank Zane, really reveal all they had and going on in their mind and in all his thoughts and stuff. You don't, like I said, you just don't get that anymore. Thank God for these old magazines, because we could still go back and read those articles when they used to be so transparent about what was going on in their brains. And someone like Frank Zane was able to articulate that and share it with everyone. All right, guys. So that's all we got for our show this week. Train hard out there. Be careful with all this COVID stuff that's going on. I hope everybody's healthy and happy. Enjoy your life, guys, because it is short. Rest in peace, John Meadows. We are going to miss you, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.